The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Introduce Shoshana Alexander. I've known Shoshana since we were in grade school, so it's really wonderful to meet have her here. She lives in Ashland, Oregon. She's lived there for many years. She's here visiting relatives in the Twin Cities. Shoshana has been a student of Buddhist meditation and philosophy since 1970. She has studied Vipassana. Her primary teachers were Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and S.N. Goenka. She is an author and an editor, and most recently she has co-authored a book with James Faraz, a well-known Vipassana teacher, and that book is going to be published in January. And the name of the book is Awakening Joy, 10 Steps on the Path to Real Happiness. And tonight she's going to talk to us. The title of her talk is Be Happy, Following the Buddha's Injunction in the Face of Challenge and Suffering. So, welcome, Shoshana.
Well, thank you, Gail. Gail's sister, Sianda, is also here. We were in the same grade together at St. Albert the Great. And, you know, I grew up on East 25th Street, very close by here. And I could never have guessed at that time that on the shores of this country, Buddhism would arrive and that I would end up, you know, when I was a kid running around, going to Catholic school, running around the river, and hanging out with Sianda. I wouldn't have known that not so much longer later I would be in a meditation hall with all of you sitting and having really benefited from this amazing teaching. So, thank you. Thank you very much for your presence here. I'm here in the Twin Cities visiting my relatives and my mother. And I'm here in this process of celebrating the holidays. So I would like to wish you first Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and Happy Solstice and Alhamdulillah. And tis the season to be jolly. So let there be no pressure. it's interesting, as probably many of you have noticed, that during this time when there's this intense call to be happy, sometimes those challenges can really arise. You know, there is good reason to have some of those challenges come up. I mean, there's sad seasonal affective disorder that a lot of you know about here because you may have even been part of the experiments at the University of Minnesota that dealt with that. Our bodies know something is going on in this season. It's dark. We take vitamin E in little tablets and go to suntan parlors. The body knows the light isn't there and that really, if you look around, there's not much to eat. In the midst of that, then, people have always built bonfires. Now we put all those lights up and call out for some kind of reassurance, connection. This morning I was listening to the Ray Conniff Singers on a record, on my mother's record player. It's a record I grew up with. Some of you may remember the Ray Conniff Singers singing, "We wish you a Merry Christmas." And it was going faster and faster. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. And you could hear the desperation. and, you know, there's reason for it. There's reason on a lot of levels. And we come together with our families during this time. And I remember one of my favorite stories from Jack Kornfield, who some of you may know, Vipassana teacher. Written a number of great books. Jack talks about having been a monk in Thailand and really come to some great understandings, depth of practice. And he came back to New York City to visit his family. He wore his robes, mind you. He came into New York City with his orange robes on. He carried his begging bowl, comes back to his mother's house, I think on Fifth Avenue, he said. Peaceful, happy, content, full of wisdom. And he hadn't been in his mother's house for more than 10 minutes before all those old reactions start coming up. So Jack always says, if you think you're enlightened, you know, just go home. And then during this season, of course, we eat lots of sweets, and maybe we end up a little agitated and grouchy. And then also, many of us during this time are still dealing with what? Physical pain, illness, sickness. We may have lost people during our past year. Last September and October, I was here helping my mother move. And one day, while I was trying to deal with her combination storm windows, not very peacefully, I was listening to Gerson Keeler, a Pray Home companion. And he was talking about a young girl who grew up in Lake Wobegon. And of course, in Lake Wobegon, she learned that things just wouldn't turn out. Things would go wrong. That's what you learn in Lake Wobegon. And you know, Gerson Keeler really has it down. He has it down about Minnesota. He has it down about human beings, which is why it works everywhere else. But he has a special thing about Minnesota, and some of you might know that. You know, you might have heard him talk about the Minnesota Language School, and I tell you, not having lived here for many years, it's real. You come back here and you say to people, you know, as Gerson Keeler said, you know, if you say to someone, if someone says to you, how are you? Don't say good or great. Say not bad, could be better. And you know, that's what my mother says. There is something in Lake Wobegon here that we are dealing with, that things could go wrong. It's cold out there. And yet, there's truth in it, because we all know things go wrong, right? We've learned this in Lake Wobegon, wherever it is we grew up. It's the first noble truth. Things go wrong. There's suffering in life. Dukkha. Now, the translation of that word, as many of you may know, is also, suffering is kind of a big conglomerate, so it's hard to grasp what precisely that might be about. But dukkha is also translated stress, unsatisfactoriness. Life is stressful. Life is unsatisfactory. Tension. All of life is held together by tension. All of matter is held together by tension. All those electrons, all the structure of cells, everything is held together by a certain tension. And so we're always in it. As long as we're in a body, there's tension, unsatisfactoriness. And we also know that it's unsatisfactory because it all changes, right? Nature. No matter what it is, no matter how good it is, it comes back to Lake Wobegon. We all know what the cause of all of this is because we experience it all the time, intimately. It's wanting things to be the way we want them to be. Attachment. So it's easy, it seems, in Buddhism, and certainly the first 20 years or so that Buddhism was here in the United States, there was a lot of focus on suffering. Life is suffering. But the third noble truth, as you all know, is about the end of suffering. The Buddha said, I teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And then the Eightfold Noble Path, which is not just about you're going to be through with suffering when you get off the wheel of samsara. You're going to be through with suffering when you finally are no longer reborn or when you've attained some goal of future enlightenment. It's right now. In the way you act, the way you live, that's the promise. The promise So really the Buddha's promise is one of happiness, that we are here to be happy. At the first line in the Dalai Lama's book on the art of happiness is, the purpose of life is to be happy. And that's a pretty straightforward statement coming from a really hardcore Buddhist. You've probably heard that saying, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be old age, sickness, death, bombing in Iraq, Afghanistan. But the Buddha's teachings are about the mind. And so whatever the pain is, whatever the situation is, it's how we respond to it that is what leads to the cessation of suffering. The suffering is optional. The pain might be there, but it's what we add to it or how we respond to it. At the end of that Lake Wobegon story, Garrison Keillor, in kind of a plea, said, people, God wants you to be happy. God wants you to be lucky. And you could hear him really asking for a lifting of some of that kind of thing that happens when we just carry around that first noble truth, there is suffering in life. I was contemplating what that meaning of happy is. And interestingly, in the etymology, the first listing of it is from the Old Norse, which a number of you can relate to here. Old Norse, hap, is the word, meaning good luck. And then it moves on to Old English, gehep, which means suitable. And that evolved into the Middle English understanding of happy, meaning favored by luck or fortune. So again, there's luck involved. Well adapted or fitting. And we have a lot of words connected to this, happen, right? Happen means occur by chance, right? There's that element of chance in there. Happenstance, due to chance. Haphazard, things kind of not in any order, just kind of falling around by chance. And so it's easy to believe that to be happy is something that just comes if you're lucky. Something that is here by chance. Well, maybe I'll be happy someday when circumstances are right or when I just get lucky enough. And the truth is that happiness is a choice. That's why we practice. We practice because we know we can make choices, that we can make a difference in our minds and in our lives. Right here at the University of Minnesota, a psychologist and behavioral geneticist, David Lycan, came up with the idea of a set point of happiness. Maybe some of you have heard about this. We supposedly have been genetically programmed, according to whatever we have inherited individually, to have a certain set point of happiness, meaning no matter... somebody caught on already... No, this was a very popular idea for about 10 years in the psychology field, and some people still carry this around, that if we win the lottery, no matter how happy we are at that moment, we will glide back down to what our set point is, genetically determined. Maybe that's David Lycan right back there, who's laughing. And if something horrible happens to us, at some point we'll glide right back up again to wherever it is that we're used to being happy. Well, a lot of recent research has indicated that the brain is very plastic. The brain, it's called plasticity, that the brain can change at any age, in fact. It's that adage about you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But you can. All the way into advanced years, the brain is still able to change. I saw this with my mother. As you know, I saw some of those habits of of really looking at the negative side of things. And as we talked about some of that, she began noticing that that's what she was doing. Instead of just being caught in this story, that's that first step, right? Noticing, that's what's happening. There's a choice. James Beres, who some of you may know, a meditation teacher, the co-author on this book, Awakening Joy, talks about going back to visit his mother, who was really caught up in worry a lot. And everything had a little negative slant to it. And he told her about this research and how it's possible through gratitude to develop a really positive state of mind to become happier. And so he suggested, how about trying something? You know, for instance, the television doesn't give good reception at points. Yes, she says, I can relate to that. Yes. Well, okay. You might say, this always happens. You know, something always goes wrong. Or you could say, the television isn't getting good reception. And my life is really very blessed. And so they tried that for the set number of days he remained there. Each time his mother would say, oh, here it is again. The phone is always ringing. You never get a moment of peace. He would say, and my life is really very blessed. After he left, he came back and home, called her a number of times, right, during the remainder of that week. You know, how's it going? She laughed. Remember, my life is really very blessed. At the end of the week, his sister, who had been out of town, returned home and said, called up James and said, what did you do to Mom? His mom is 92. It's possible. It's possible to change. It's possible to, actually, as many of you probably have seen, make really deep, deep changes in life. We learn how the mind works in Buddhist practice. And by learning that, we learn how we can make choices in response to whatever is happening. That's really one of the main points of the practice, right? That we carry it into our lives and can have enough spaciousness around whatever is happening to make choices. As we change our minds, we change our brains. That's what's going on in neuroscience. Some of you may know Sharon Begley's book by that title, Change Your Mind, Change Your Brain. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin has been doing a lot of research with Tibetan lamas. They hook them up to different kinds of systems, measuring what's going on in their brains. They put them through MRIs while they're meditating, while they're doing compassion practice, and have been really beginning to see what happens just as the mind is affected, what goes on in the brain. The brain has evolved to register negative experiences far more readily than positive ones. It was a survival mechanism. It was being on the lookout all the time for what might go wrong in order to avert that. And so we really do truly have a tendency to focus more on the negative. It's the function of the amygdala, that little thing in your brain that keeps looking at what might go wrong. It stores negative emotions so you can remember and be ready the next time. Rick Hansen, who is a psychologist and a neuroscientist, talks about the fact that one negative experience with a dog can override thousands of positive experiences. So, right, the dog comes wagging its tail up, right? You pet the dog, you have a lot of good memories connected with that, right? Lovely experiencing petting that fur, how happy the dog is to see you. That one time that you may approach a dog and it bares its teeth and maybe snaps at you, the next time you see a dog, your response is most likely going to be fear, rather than that kind of happiness that you'd gotten used to. If you think back, you might remember some of those, somehow that how that happens in your brain. Rick Hansen says, our brains are Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. Just notice how that works. I'd like to read you a little quote from Rick Hansen. Be because we're set up in this way, we can go through life doing the things that confirm our worst fears. We look for what's negative in a situation just in case it's a survival threat. Because our brain is set up to be wary, we have to help ourselves toward happiness by inclining our attention to positive experiences. Inclining our attention to positive experiences, consciously intending to do so. Deliberately looking for positive experiences, taking them in and being present with them. This helps the brain register positive experiences long enough for those neurons that are firing together positively to start wiring together. So that's a statement in neuroscience, that neurons that fire together wire together. So you pet the dog, you are happy, right? Those neurons with that fur, right, with the dog wagging its tail, and your happy feelings are wiring together. That's why you're all very happy next time you see that dog. And it's the same thing in forming habits of any sort. So you smoke a cigarette. Right? Maybe nobody does that anymore. I hope not. I don't. But I used to. And there were ways, now let's forget about the nicotine part, but there were ways connected with that, right? I would remember getting agitated, emotionally agitated, upset. My boyfriend, right? Something had happened. I would smoke a cigarette and connect the relaxation connected up with that cigarette and the distraction with something good that let me divorce myself from what was going on emotionally. In fact, I've heard that cigarette smoke, nicotine, breaks synaptic connections. And that's why people in emotional trauma smoke cigarettes, because it does release some of that emotional trauma going on. Well, I don't want to get into a whole thing about selling cigarettes. But it was just a funny example that arose in my mind. But you begin developing a psychological habit. Forget about the nicotine, but the psychological habit is something good comes out of this action. And those neurons that fire together wire together. All habits are, that's what happens with all of them. So again, through the practice, we interrupt. We interrupt the habit by shining the light on it, by looking at it. The Buddha said, whatever the practitioner most frequently thinks or ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So, if you tend to worry about the future, get caught up in resentment about the past, anger about things that happened, fear about things that might happen, whatever the mind most frequently ponders will become the inclination of the mind. That's how your mind will continue going. On the other side, if you make those choices to pay attention, this is not to be Pollyanna-ish, but to just notice what are the good things that happen in life, or to cultivate gratitude. Just for a moment right now, think of something that you feel grateful for, someone or something. Just let that come to mind. And notice in yourself what happens. Does anybody want to say, what happens? What happens in that moment that you think of something you're grateful for? You felt excited?
Well-being.
Well-being? How did that register? How did you know that was well-being?
Because of the
feeling. Oh, here you are. Okay.
Because of the peace and the warmth.
That good. Yeah, you felt warmth. Where? Do you remember where? And where in your body you felt the warmth?
Yes, right here.
Yeah, interesting. Did anybody else notice that? Right, it's really impossible to feel gratitude and at the same time be negative or unhappy. It's a great skillful means that if you're feeling really negative or caught up in something, to pause for a moment and think of something you feel grateful for, or notice something you feel grateful for, and that arises. It arises right away in the body. It arises if those muscles in your face, right, lift. They, you know, there's research about that one as well. You just lift those muscles, and something happens in the whole body. The Buddha also urged us to develop and increase wholesome states. Use the mind to do that. So I'd like to do a little exercise right now that will use the imagination in this process of learning how to make choices, how to choose to be happy. Some of you may have heard of the five-finger piano exercise at Harvard Medical Center. They did research on the imagination. One group of students was asked to do a five-finger piano exercise once a day, every day, for a week, just to sit and do this over and over again for a period of time. Simple exercise. The other group was asked to do the same exercise, but just imagining it. And they were watched. It was a controlled setting. They were observed so that they were not moving their fingers at all, only imagining that they were moving their fingers in the same exact little sequence that the others were playing on the piano. At the end of the week, when the brains were measured, the same area of the brain same area of the brain in both groups had increased. There were significant increases in that area of the brain. Far more in those who did the actual exercise, but the same kind of thing was going on just through the imagination. So I'm saying this because using the imagination, we make fire together neurons that then wire together. We begin to create an inclination of the mind. Good things are happening all the time. Negative things are happening. But there's a way to incline the mind in a way that allows more happiness and joy into our lives. And actually, if you notice, life itself seems to have a quality of joyfulness inherent in it, which is why we say joy is inherent in us. If you look at a baby who is cared for well, is joyous, is happy. It's a quality that remains in us. So today, well, we're actually in a very special time of the year. We're on the 23rd of December, 2 days after the solstice. So we've just seen a turn toward the light, metaphorically, figuratively, actually. And we're 2 days before Christmas, which is culturally the birth of the light. So we're here right in the middle of this time. This is just a nice time to think about choices, about how we can choose either going toward darkness or toward light inside ourselves. So if you would just close your eyes a moment and let yourself settle in. And let yourself recall some positive experience that you've had. It can be anything, from something very small and pleasant to perhaps seeing someone you haven't seen a long time, someone you love. And as you remember that experience, maybe color it in a bit. See what kinds of colors are there. Any sounds or sights, tastes, fragrances. And now as you let yourself be with that experience, bring your attention into your body and notice what you're feeling. There may be, as this one man said, a warmth in the chest. Perhaps tingling in the arms, Notice what happens in your state of mind. And then continuing with that experience, let yourself intensify that feeling. Just let the sensations grow stronger. Or notice if there's a way to let the feeling of contentment or peace or joy or love increase. And now just return to your breath. Just letting yourself settle back again. And then very gently, let yourself remember a challenging time. It might be a difficulty you've had with someone else, a painful time, a loss. And notice what happens in your body. To the state of your mind. And then, almost like turning back toward the light, let the remembrance of that happy time that you brought up into your mind before, that positive experience, let your mind turn toward that again. And just notice what happens as you allow your imagination, your memory, to recall. And bringing yourself fully back into whatever that positive experience is. Letting yourself return to your breath. And then if you'll take a few minutes, just turn to someone near you and share what may have happened to you in that experience. That's it. Thank you. I was going to ask for the bell, but that gong was better. Well, I want to have enough time for some discussion. One of the things I loved when I was here last September and came to the sitting here was that so many people shared their own wisdom. It was really great. That was a wonderful way of interacting here. But I do want to mention a few other things just about skillful means. This can be one of the skillful means. It's just turning your mind, inclining your mind in a positive direction. There is suffering. There is challenge. And how we respond to it makes a difference in whether we're turning toward the light or toward the darkness. Whether we are expanding and opening or whether we're contracting. Whether we're moving toward freedom in our minds or enslavement to habits. So in face of our own mental suffering, we can learn increasingly that we can make choices. We can choose to find the joy, find the happiness, find the peace. One excellent way, of course, is always mindfulness. Just whatever is happening, first to allow it. Non-judgmental awareness. Just allowing, not tightening around whatever might be happening if it's a difficulty. And as we just allow without judgment, without thinking that anger is wrong or that aversion is wrong, just noticing, we see those three conditions. We see anicca, dukkha, anatta. We see that there is suffering. We see that everything changes. And we see that it's not our mind, but that it's the mind, the human mind. It just happens as a matter of conditions. Remaining open to the suffering rather than tightening or closing allows our hearts to remain open to when it changes or to when the joy arises. An open heart is actually a joyful heart. So even in the midst of experiencing pain, our own or that of others, there can be a kind of joy. Compassion is an interesting experience in that. Compassion is so heart-opening that even though it's dealing with suffering, there's actually a kind of a goodness of feeling that goes along with it because the heart is so open. Having compassion for oneself, remembering yourself as a child, as a baby, when there's difficulties, when you're in the midst of just feeling like, monstrous, knowing that you once were a child, knowing that you are a human mind caught in circumstances. And another thing that is very useful when it's especially overwhelming, going to nature and praying, an interesting concept in the Buddhist context. But I want to read you something from a wonderful Tibetan Lama, Anam Tupten. He lives in Berkeley. He was a Lama who escaped from Tibet, walked over the mountains. He writes, "I remember the time I was trekking from Tibet to Nepal with a few other people." This is an understatement. He wasn't trekking, he was escaping in a very dangerous situation. He says it was very dangerous. And there was only a little bit of moonlight. It wasn't very bright, and we didn't have flashlights. At one point, we had to cross a fast-moving, thunderous, cascading river full of icy water. There was no bridge. There was just one log that we had to walk on to cross the river. I was terrified. In that moment, I prayed out of pure fear. In that moment of total fear, I had forgotten all of my meditative techniques. All of my fancy visualizations were gone, as well as all of my ways of analyzing mental states. Everything was gone. I was so terrified I couldn't remember anything. But when I prayed, I felt this sudden bliss, calmness, and courage. I walked perfectly across the log, and I don't know how I did it. This has nothing to do with a miracle of divine intervention. This is simply about letting go of all delusions, all concepts, all fears, and just trusting in what is. What is always perfect. We either die or we live. We are either poor or we are rich. We are either loved or hated by others. No matter, we are always perfect in what is. So I would like to quickly just tell a little story of something that happened recently to me that was connected with this. When I was in Minnesota last time, two months, I ended up in one of those conflicts with relatives that happens. I don't know how it is, but with relatives, it can be one of the worst. It's amazing. And it was not resolving. I went back home. I wrote a very nice little email message and got back a spam. I thought, okay, I'll try another email message. Maybe that one wasn't right. And I tried I statements, and I tried, you know, whatever I could. You know, meanwhile, I was going through my own stuff. I was justifying myself. I was going through all my stories about this and how, you know, he was wrong and I was right and the whole shebang. Wrote the next message and got back a blast that ended with, "Dysfunctional, you're top dog." It was great. It was like, wow, how dare you say that to me? So it went on like this, and so every morning I would wake up and think, oh, this is still going on. You know, what is it? What is it? How can I get through it? And I really didn't know how. I couldn't get through my own resentment and anger. I couldn't get through what was, you know, I would try and practice. I would send him loving kindness meditation every morning. All this was still there. Well, last Sunday, my son and I, who is here, went to a Native American longhouse, which is a wonderful combination, sort of a Quaker meeting, encounter group, and a church service. Lots of drumming and chanting. People could stand up in between each song and speak. And they could speak a prayer, they could speak what they were feeling about anything. And a number of people talked about what was going on for them in a conflict in the group. And they actually even addressed people in the group. In between, they would sit down, drum and chant. Another person would stand up and speak, always from the heart. Sit down, drumming and chanting, praying. I said at some point in there, I could hear the conflict in all of them. It felt like the conflict in me. It felt like the conflict between me and this relative. And I just thought, I am turning this over. I'm praying. I'm letting this over to something else. I don't know what. But I don't know what to do about this. More drumming and chanting. And at a certain point, I could feel it was like layers coming off by just surrendering, letting go, saying, I don't know. None of my practices are working. I don't know. Metta doesn't even work. And letting it go. And by the end of that longhouse, the resentment was gone. The anger was gone. I felt neutral. I got home that afternoon, later in the evening, and there were messages on my phone. I listened to his phone messages. There's one from that relative. And he said, I was driving along home from work today, and all of a sudden I felt like I was hugging you. And I could feel the warmth of your body, and I could see your smile. And I miss you. I love you. I feel like I've hurt you, and I'm sorry. And he said, it was like, I see. Either it happened during the longhouse, or what happened to me in the longhouse let me receive what had happened to him. So I just want to say, in the face of suffering, difficulties, conflict, there are a lot of skillful means. And maybe for now, one of the ultimate is just surrender in prayer. Just that giving up. I don't know. It's what Job did, right? You know the story of Job, right? Everything goes wrong with Job. His cattle die and he gets boiled and his wife and kids die and all this stuff, right? He keeps going to people saying, what's wrong? And they say, you know, you think the wrong way. You know, or you're not giving enough money. Or, you know, it's because what you did, you know, when you were younger. You know, it's what you did in your past life, Job. You know, it's all coming back to you now. And Job goes on, right, trying to find out. Well, at some point he goes to God. He says, God, I don't know what's up. I have no idea why everything is going wrong. Then God says, that's right, Job. You don't have any idea. It's complete surrender. And God gives him everything back. back comes the cattle and the wives and the boils go away. So there's a kind of magic in this. Okay, last thing I want to say here is we don't have to be perfect to be happy. Sometimes we think, oh yeah, right, we have all these intentions. We have to be good. We have to do wholesome things. We don't always do that. You know, my son is here. If he's a witness to the fact that you don't have to be perfect to be happy. right, we fall and we come back up again. I read on outside a church, actually, a little sign that said, failure is not falling down, it's staying down. So we just keep our intention, right? Our intention to be good, our intention to do wholesome actions, our intention to be happy. And my final question always to myself is, do I have the right to be happy in face of all the suffering in the world? No, it's a big one. There's so much suffering. I want to read a poem from Jack Gilbert to finish up. It's called A Brief for the Defense. Jack Gilbert is a Buddhist poet. Sorrow everywhere. Slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they're starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness in their future, smiling and laughing while someone in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages in Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit that there will be music, despite everything. We stand at the prow again of a small ship, anchored late at night in the tiny port, looking over to the sleeping island. The waterfront is three shuttered cafes and one naked light burning. To hear the faint sound of oars in the silence as a rowboat comes slowly out and then goes back is truly worth all the years of sorrow that are yet to come. So we have just a few minutes for comments and questions. I'm sorry I went on so long.
I've spent a bit of time in the East, and in Thailand I would see people come to work and stick an incense in and pray. And I would go up to a lot of people and ask, well, what do you pray for? And 9 out of 10 said, luck. Pray for luck.
Luck.
And actually that's been coming up for a lot for me lately, and it's something about circumstances in my life are purely chance. Yes, I make decisions, but it's luck that I think I'm just thinking about.
It's interesting. It's interesting because that's that point about if we think that it's only luck, then why are we doing the practice? That the practice is about making choices despite whatever the circumstances are, right? Whatever, we're not always lucky. Boy, And sometimes that all there is to make the choice in response to the circumstance to remain equanimous, not go down.
Or sometimes we're always lucky.
Or sometimes we're always lucky.
Like we are always, always lucky.
Like yes.
You said about, and blessed is my life.
Yes. And my life is really very blessed. It's true, isn't it? It's amazing. Oh, just looking at people in the airport the other day. All the planes are late. But I thought, we are here. We are warm. We have food. We are in the heaven realms. And we should all be blissed out, considering. Right? Were you going to say something? Who was it? Somebody else had a hand up over here. Anybody else? I think Gail is going to want to make those announcements in 1 minute. Right? Anything else?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be with you, to sit with you. Okay, Gail. I want to get you out of here before the snow gets deeper.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.